Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday,
1 p.m.
Eastern Standard Time,
and
you're listening to you with your host, Venger Satanis, and the Beast.
Hey, thanks for tuning in. My name's T.C. Downey, and this is my co-host, Venger Satanis. Venger, how you doing today, man?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fairly well, considering.
Good. All things considered, or considering the relative position of the universe and mankind therein?
I'm going to answer yes to both, considering all things.
Okay. Cool. For those people that are, all three people that are currently listening to us and looking at our Blog Talk Radio page, I want to apologize because I set up the show and it was supposed to be Ospensky, as most people probably know, because we give out the schedule of the show ahead of time on the Ooze, on my channel, High Priest Satanis, for anyone on YouTube that wants to join or be my friend or whatever. But I had the Gurdjieff book in front of me, which I'm currently reading, Gurdjieff, An Introduction to His Life and Ideas by John Shirley. And I don't know what happened. I set up the show so we would be talking about Gurdjieff, when really we're talking about Ospensky. However, maybe unconsciously, I did that on purpose because Ospensky seems to not get nearly as much limelight as Gurdjieff. And Ospensky seems to, at least to me and a few others, seems to fall in the shadow of Gurdjieff almost constantly. I think much of his life he was overshadowed by Gurdjieff, and now he is again on our radio show, The Ooze. So sorry, Ospensky, but I'm sure Beast Zeno will fix that sometime this week after we're done here.
What I'll actually probably do is leave the original oops up there and add a update.
Oh, okay,
so
that works too.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll help. I'll actually probably paraphrase what you just said about Ospensky always kind of sinking into the shadow of Gurdjieff.
Yes. I like that, sinking into the shadow. Yeah.
Well, it's in essence what he was doing. I mean, the issue at hand here really is Ospensky had such an incredible level of admiration for Gurdjieff that he almost instinctively took the beta role rather than the alpha role.
Right.
Even though I guess it could be argued that he was more of an alpha than Gurdjieff himself. And so.
Yeah, I agree. I think they were both alphas, and that's what led to whatever rift or possibly schism or offshoot or just different approaches that they took. I think Ospensky, at least much in the beginning, and even now posthumously, Ospensky plays second fiddle to Gurdjieff a lot. But I think during the later years of their lives, Ospensky did come into his own, and he did a lot of great work, and he kind of took the fourth way in a whole different direction and did his own thing, and I seem to recall from my reading that sometimes Ospensky questioned the man because he had all this wisdom, and yet sometimes he displayed it in such a way that it made Gurdjieff out to be you know, not as idyllic or as godlike as Ouspensky had once assumed in the beginning.
Right. Well, what I think's happened here is we as people, we always tend to give props to the person that, you know, brought light this new information. Or, you know, we're always all about the pioneers or the discoverers. Like, for instance, you know, everybody knows who made the, you know, made the first car, but nobody knows, you know, who made the most improvements on the car.
Yeah. That's very true.
That makes, so I think that's what has happened in this case. Gurdjieff, you know, he had a very intuitive method of understanding the fourth way and in general understanding reality in the universe. It was all very instinct-based and primal in origin. Ouspensky was incredibly meticulous and incredibly detail-oriented and incredibly well thought. I mean,
right? Yeah, I think it speaks to the intellectual center in man a lot more than Gurdjieff's approach. I mean, Gurdjieff's approach was more physical and more emotional, and still some intellectual, but less so than Ouspensky.
Certainly, certainly. Well, speaking of Gurdjieff, we got a little bit of feedback from one of our listeners, Eva Luke, and well, we'd like to address that. So, Bender, if you would be so kind as to read his feedback.
Sure. I originally got this on YouTube, and I told the guy to post it on the forum because then everybody can see it instead of just me. Okay, he starts out, "Hi, Priest Satanus," as about Gurdjieff. "Hi, Venger. Hope you are well. I listened to your Blog Talk radio show on Gurdjieff the other night and thought it was awesome. I got myself a copy of The Fourth Way by Ouspensky recently, and I'm slowly getting through it," which I might add, that's what I would suggest. I don't think, I mean, even if someone breezes through it, I think you have to go back and reread it two or three times before you get the full amount. Anyway, that's
I agree.
Yeah. But if you're planning on just reading it once thoroughly, you should read it slowly, a little bit at a time, and be able to digest what you read, like, over a matter of weeks or months. Okay, anyway, moving on. By the way, I've read your PDF versions of The Cthulhu Cult and Liber AO, and think they are really enlightening and a great mesh of the things I like, such as The Fourth Way, Satanism, Left-Hand Path, Ancient Ones. The radio show helped clarify some of the things that I was struggling to absorb, and it's not the easiest read. I work a 9-to-5 as well and are constantly looking for moments I can practice the work. It's actually a system that has results that you can feel once you start practicing it. I've been into a lot of things like Levian Satanism, Eastern Occultism, and meditation over the years, but this fourth way really is working for me. So, as I feel shifts in perception quite regularly and more of a sense of control of my life and being more awake to the fact that I've been so asleep all this time. Wow, that was a run-on sentence. LOL. Anyway, brother, keep well and keep up the awesomeness. I shall. Anyway, that was it. I think the main point you wanted to address, Bucino, was that this guy works a 9-to-5 job, as many of us do, or something similar, and his mindset or his premise is that he has to focus on the work when he's not working, you know, between in his off hours.
Right.
Oh, so, yeah. You have something to say about that? So
I
take
do.
It away.
I do. In the book written by Ouspensky, In Search of the Miraculous, in Chapter 7, he's very clear to very, very clear to put a lot of emphasis on the fact that the work is not something that you have to pause to do. The work is something that can be accomplished while you're walking down the street, or you're taking a bath, or you're physically working. The work is in all things. What makes the fourth way, what makes it so miraculous, is that the three prior traditions all required a heavy amount of dedication and a lot of negligence on other aspects of life in favor of putting particular influence on the type of aspect that you're trying to approach it by. For instance, the Buddhists spent an incredibly long period of time in meditation, in stillness, and thought, and therefore, you know, they give up a lot of other things like interaction with other people, and you know, their sacrifice is made in the wrong sense. Of course, we know through the works of Gurdjieff and Ouspensky that struggling and suffering are necessary to, you know, transcend a higher level of consciousness. But as with anything, if you have a knife and you make a cut in the wrong spot, you're just creating a bigger problem for yourself than if you make a more precise cut. And that's what the fourth way is to its three predecessors. It's a more precise cut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. And yeah, I agree. I think, and that's what we talked about a couple of weeks ago with the whole Gurdjieff aspect, is that you've got to consciously work and consciously do all your little daily tasks. You know, do them in the present moment and be mindful of them while you're doing them, and, you know, live your life in such a way that, I don't know, that you're doing it consciously and you're not just going through the motions or living automatically or, you know, drifting through life. You've got to, you know, everything you do, whether it's, even if it's plunging a toilet, you know, which every once in a while I have to do sometimes, you know, you should plunge that toilet the correct way and with a full sense of awareness, and, you know, actually do it to the, you know, the fullest extent of your ability, and be aware of yourself and what you're doing, you know, at the time while you're plunging. And so, yeah, the whole world is your laboratory for experimenting with the fourth way in the work. So, yeah, don't just do it, you know, after you get off work and before you turn on the TV. Every moment is a new opportunity to work on yourself.
It's actually really fascinating that this whole reply to the Gurdjieff show was posted this morning, because it falls in line heavily with a lot of the concepts that Ouspensky puts out, you know, throughout the years of his work, especially in the latter half of it. We were talking about earlier, you and I were talking about his book, A New Model of the Universe, that I believe that was the name of it.
Yep.
In that book, Ouspensky is describing the fourth dimension and explaining how it can't be scientifically categorized or mathematically explained, except if you allow special circumstances. That part itself is very relevant to what he describes as being the fourth dimension, where third dimension describes the space that is occupied by matter. The fourth dimension is the absence of matter, the perceived space from there. So in that light, I'm trying to remember exactly the direction I wanted to take this. So give me just a second. Things are a little bit outside of their normal characteristic today. So.
Okay, I'm
sorry.
I'm actually trying to Google it.
What are you actually trying to Google?
Ouspensky in the fourth dimension.
And the fourth dimension. You're looking for somebody who's already chopped it up. I got it.
Yeah, I suppose. Just someone else's take. I think he talks about it in a lot of other things in his first book, I believe is his first book, Tertium Organum, the third canon of thought. I don't think that's going to help me now. Let's see. And there's, of course, good old Wikipedia.
It's going to get a little windy for just a second here, man. What's fascinating about this fourth dimension concept is it's what was I actually comparing it to earlier? It's parallel with the fourth way itself, and the idea that with the fourth way you're synergizing these three methods of obtaining higher enlightenment, and you're using them all in one fluid. You're using them in all in one fluid motion rather than specifically stopping and focusing on one particular point at one particular time.
Yeah.
Now, how this relates to the fourth dimension is the concept of the current. Now the current is a constant moving energy. We know because we use this to actually animate and mobilize ourselves. You know, it's putting that energy into action in a conscious way. It becomes mechanical after you've mastered it, but to start it off, to begin it, you know, you have to consciously observe, you know, how you got up onto your knees and observe how you got up onto your feet and observe how you took that first step and watch how other people outside of you are doing it. And I think in that light, there's a lot of a lot being said about the work itself.
Yeah, I did find something. If you want me to read it,
what do you have?
Okay, this is from some website. It's. Let me try to sound it out. KadenKahesselink.net. I don't know. Okay, anyway. The best known work on the fourth dimension, however, is probably the Tertium Organum of P.D. Ouspensky. This combines the objective and subjective approaches to the subject and is of peculiar interest to students of the secret doctrine because it seems to cast a good deal of light on what may have been meant when Madame Blavatsky speaks of Earth's humanity in the second round being of two-dimensional species, an expression which leads on to her more general observations on dimension already referred to, but which remains itself largely unexplained. Ouspensky held that an animal has, when he described as a two-dimensional view of life, he did not mean, of course, that the animal could not live quite comfortably in a three-dimensional world, or that a dog could not bury a bone. What he was concerned with was the dog's mental view of what occurs, and he regarded this as fundamentally two-dimensional. Ouspensky's explanation of what he meant by two-dimensional consciousness is worthy of careful study, unobscured by any preconceptions we may have. His account of the difference between how a horse may be understood to see and interpret a scene and how a human may do so is very plausible. He then went on to claim that there is a further view as much beyond the ordinary three-dimensional human mental image as that is beyond the understanding of the horse.
And that being the fourth dimension.
Yeah, which I guess presupposes the idea that that we could view consciousness in the light of a fifth and sixth and even seventh dimension. You know, there's always more to see, and there's always more to take into account and to understand.
Right, I agree. I agree entirely. As a matter of fact, the description alone that Ouspensky uses in describing what he refers to as the undescribable, being the fourth dimension, that in itself is, magic of words, you know. I don't know how else to really express what I'm saying, but I wish that I actually had the reference chapter page. I'm thinking it was around. No, that was where the other thing was. Okay, I'm not really sure what the page was, but what I was quoting from in chapter 7 of In Search of the Miraculous, I just remembered, is on page 144. So,
yeah.
Sorry.
People aren't going to, you know, flip to their manual and follow along with us, but I don't know. What else do you want to say about Ouspensky and what he was about?
Let me see. What did we discuss earlier? This is why I told you, because I was sure that I'd be a little bit discombobulated.
Like at the top of the show, we discussed how Ouspensky was kind of looking or sunk into the shadow of Gurdjieff. And then we talked about how Ouspensky was more intellectually centered than Gurdjieff. And,
Observation. Observation, that was something. Ouspensky, like Gurdjieff, but in the same aspect, completely different than Gurdjieff, was a master of observation. Ouspensky, as you get to know him through his writing, you learn his level of detail-orientedness comes from very, very deep, insightful observations and an extremely talented comparison skill. I don't know if there's actually a word for having a skill of comparison, but that's what he had. You know, he could very easily... Pardon me?
So you like to compare things? Is that what you're saying?
And what I'm saying is that he was good at comparing things. As a matter of fact, he even gave a formula for how we come about creating analogies. Analogies are formed once we've observed something inside of ourselves and found its counterpart outside of ourselves, when the behaviors are completely fluid and completely similar, you're then able to draw an analogy between those two.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think that speaks of Ouspensky's methodology and his the intellectual basis of his interpretation of the work. Because he's, you know, he reasons things out. He's a problem solver. He views things in comparison, one thing to another, and that's just how his mind works. That's, you know, that's his strong point. And so it's definitely a different way of looking at the work, and a different way to experience it. And I think for those people that also are more intellectually geared than, you know, physically or instinctually or emotionally, I think that's, you know, it's probably easier for people to adhere and understand Ouspensky than it is Gurdjieff, who basically Gurdjieff would, you know, shout things that, you know, would immediately rub you the wrong way, and then he would tell you to, like, you know, start shoveling. And so that kind of speaks to both the physical and the emotional centers. And then later, I guess, if you grasp the fullness of the thing, it kind of sunk in the intellectual ramifications of, you know, the terror of the situation and how we're all, you know, imprisoned and basically puppets to, you know, these forces and these desires that each little part of us is a slave to. So, do you, all things considered, do you personally get more out of Ouspensky than Gurdjieff, or the other way around?
I'm going to be completely honest with you, man. It's the same. If either way, I don't get it the same way. I get a completely different. Materialization or visualization, and then after materialization, depending on which author I'm following, I believe that their two approaches are so completely different that I can take away value from each one that doesn't interfere with the value or necessarily agree with the value of what the other is saying.
Right.
You know, just as when you and I are talking, I can walk away with a whole different set of ideas than I walk away when I'm talking to, let's say, Jason Sorrell, or if I'm watching a Jason King video, or talking to my best friend about his cancer. I guess it's just, all in all, you learn something from how the person is,
mm-hmm.
How they present themselves, how they present the information that they're giving to you. Like, for instance, most people, I don't know for sure most people, but I'm sure there are people out there that listen to me talking on this show and think I'm just rambling utter nonsense. I know there's been a time or two where you've actually gone, "What the hell are you talking about?" So,
sure, but you know, I think the same can be said for anybody.
Oh, certainly, but that's the whole point of it, is that I can draw from Ouspensky and Gurdjieff in a parallel, but at the same time going in two completely different directions.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, yeah, they're very similar and very different at the same time. I agree with that. Yeah.
One of the things that they both agreed on was that this system was superior to predecessor systems, just in the fact that this work could be done all day long, every day, and beyond that, advancements could be made in huge leaps, where it would take sometimes and a very good portion of a person's life to move just a little bit, and the three prior forms of esoteric devotion.
Right. So working on the physical, the emotional, and the intellectual together at the same time is clearly superior to working on them separately or individually. Yeah, I agree with that. I think anybody that's tried the work or experienced it for themselves or just read, Ouspensky or Gurdjieff, I think everybody understands that that's clearly the case. And it is just, it seems very obvious once you think about it that, it's better to grow the whole person than grow one small side of that person and leave the other portions barren. It's just, that doesn't make any sense. Then, have a whole well-rounded person. You have a person with huge imbalances. And, that's not particularly healthy for anyone. So, but to answer my own question, I think if someone put, a gun to my head and forced me to choose, I think I would have to say that I get more out of Gurdjieff than Ouspensky, but there's so little of Gurdjieff actually talking about the work in the printed form rather than Ouspensky that if I was just going on, the volume of writing, I guess I would have to go with Ouspensky because he wrote a lot more about it, and in fact, a lot of the stuff that we know about Gurdjieff's teaching is In Search of the Miraculous by Ouspensky, and, you know, Ouspensky wrote that. So, you know, Gurdjieff himself, it seems, wrote very little. And what he did, it seems, some of it seems too tied up in, metaphor or allegory, or like the whole Beelzebub's tales to his grandson. I tried reading that, and I just couldn't get into it because, I don't know. And a lot of people at the time read it and couldn't get into it and were just like, no, this sucks. But Ouspensky is, you know, he writes very clearly, and he reasons things out, and he draws comparisons and parallels to things that we can relate to, and it's easier to understand. But sometimes I worry that it's so defined and linear and clear-cut that we miss the substance and the fire that's in the core message of the work, and that's that we are in desperate need of change, would we but know it. And that is the terror of the situation, that we're, you know, hopelessly imprisoned slaves, doomed to suffer in a meaningless existence until we wake up, and until we even know that we're living in that way, and it's possible to wake up, there's absolutely no hope for us to better our situation. And I think at times Gurdjieff nails that more, and gets people motivated, gets people fired up and energized. But then I think to rely on the intellectual narrative that Ouspensky provides, that gives a great deal of benefit as well.
Oh, absolutely. The way I look at it, the difference between Gurdjieff and Ouspensky, as far as at least their writing styles go and their method of teaching, Gurdjieff was more of a hands-on student, and Ouspensky was more of a book student. In my opinion, Gurdjieff felt that you could observe him and watch his behaviors and listen to the peculiar way that he talked about things, and in the end of that, you're given kind of a model to follow. Ouspensky, on the other hand, his model was completely different. He drew the schematics up for how it worked, you know, how the model actually worked. He was so much in hero worship and such a student of observation that he studied Gurdjieff relentlessly.
Mm-hmm. And yet he went his own way, which I think is very interesting. And maybe that kind of came at a certain, you know, point of crisis or a certain breakdown when he realized that, you know, Gurdjieff wasn't God. Gurdjieff was just a man who perhaps had even stumbled accidentally on something extremely valuable to mankind. But, you know, after a while, Ouspensky was not, you know, did not slavishly approach the fourth wave as Gurdjieff did. He did his own thing. And
I agree entirely. As a matter of fact, what I really think, because Gurdjieff was as good as he was at observation, he realized that was the impending nature of his relationship with Ouspensky, and so he actually sent Ouspensky away for a good period of 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly, I would have to reread the chapter, but I believe it was 10 years that he sent Ouspensky away. And they both reunited in Paris, you know, 10 years later for a very short time. And I believe that that's when Ouspensky realized that the student had become the teacher.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. And then I don't think it was too long after that that Ouspensky died. And then a couple of years later, Gurdjieff died as well.
Right. what both of them left behind was this thing that I believe we'll be pondering well into the days of Star Trek, you know?
I hope so. I think so. You know, it might be dressed in new clothes. Things like the power of now, and, you know, there's other different, slightly different approaches, like neuro-linguistic programming and what we're doing with the Cthulhu cult. But, you know, slight variations on the theme, basically the work dressed in the clothes of the day or the teachers of the day, any particular guru. But, yeah, I think the work in its essence won't change and will be remembered and studied, yeah, long after we're gone.
We have a question posed to us on the in the chat room right now, and it's way off of this topic, but I think
then we shall smite them.
That we should possibly do.
Let me get the chat room too.
Yeah, I know it just kicked me out.
Sorry.
Oh, that's all right.
Okay, this is this question. How do the two left-hand path magicians, Gurdjieff and Ouspensky, differ in their writing?
No, that's not the question I was talking about. We answered
what do you think of Zechariah Sitchin?
Yes, Zechariah Sitchin. Sitchin, actually. You do know who he is, right?
I don't think so.
He is the author of the Ancient Astronauts theory. He's
really?
The beginning of that, yes.
I thought that was someone named Dannon or something.
Here it says, I'm looking right at the Wikipedia page. It says, Zechariah Sitchin is an author of books promoting an explanation for human origins involving ancient astronauts. So maybe he didn't actually found this, and
right.
So that might be why we're incorrect.
Okay, yeah, I don't think he was the first.
But this dude's the guy who basically gives the Anunnaki Kai their alien origins.
These theories have been popularized, particularly in the latter half of the 20th century, by writers Eric von Daniken, that's who I was thinking of, Zechariah Sitchin, and Robert K.G. Temple, and David Icke, or I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but yeah, it's, we talked about it in a different show, that basically, yeah, I think, that's possible. It's probably likely that some alien intelligence, has visited Earth, and definitely, in my mind, mankind didn't just evolve on his own naturally, with the faculties that he has. His evolution was guided or influenced by external alien entities.
Right. Oh. My take on this guy is he's an awesome romance fiction novelist. Of course, the possibility of alien intervention in our genetics is purely plausible, and I think it's maybe even heavily indicated through our own biological studies as humans. I think the notion of them actually having sex with primitive monkeys is, I think that that's where the problem, the fault in the thinking of it lies.
Yeah. Is that what that Zechariah guy talks about?
I don't know particularly if he's,
cause the guy in the chat room mentioned it just now.
Yeah. I don't know if that particularly knows where, if that's where it's coming from, but I'm assuming perhaps. I just don't think that I myself, considering myself to be intellectually superior to a good portion of this planet, I wouldn't have sex with a primate or a Neanderthal, and I'm not that far off with their genetic, you know,
their
genetic coding. So to me, it's more reasonable that if there was any kind of altercation done to the genes or the DNA structures in humans, it was done in a laboratory, or it was done in a scientific method.
Right. Or you could say, you know, supernaturally or by magic. But then, of course, you can also say that the supernatural and magic is just a different form of technology and science that we're not aware of yet.
Actually, Panshoff, just a little note here. Physicist Thomas Campbell makes mention in his video, My Big Toe. You can find it on YouTube. Just look for My Big Toe. In that video, he mentions that the genes, the chromosomes, are the exact same as what's in an actual monkey. It's just two of them have been spliced together. Have been kind of fused together. So that's actually the medical, you know, of course it takes time after those have been fused together, and I'm guessing, you know, a couple thousand years for man to completely evolve, and that's why you have the limited quantities, but still evident different layers or links between that supposed evolution. And, at least this is my view on it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there, every once in a while there's a link, but then I think there's enough gaps in the links that that it raises even more questions. Here at the end
certainly.
Of that Wikipedia thing, a 2004 article in Skeptic magazine states that von Däniken plagiarized many of the book's concepts from Le Matin des Magiciens, which is Morning of the Magicians. That this book in turn was heavily influenced by the Cthulhu mythos, and that the core of the ancient astronaut theory originates in H.P. Lovecraft's short stories, The Call of Cthulhu and At the Mountains of Madness. And then, of course, we come full circle.
Of course. So, either way, I mean, honestly, it doesn't matter to me. It's interesting to hear the different theories of how we've evolved or how evolution actually is processed or takes place, but I mean, what's really going on here, and a lot of the problem with religion as it stands in modern day is that we're so busy focusing on the crystal clear hindsight, trying to pick out the details, that we're not putting an emphasis on the right now, and that, you know, in itself shapes the future. What happens right now is directly proportional to the shape the future will take. What's happened in the past is only an indication of what the possibilities are.
Right.
So, that is another good question. Are you seeing this one?
No, I logged off the chat.
Okay, that's fine. I'll read it to you, and we can try to tackle this.
Okay.
Panshoff wants to know if we believe the top-down theory or the bottom-up theory.
Of evolution? Or?
I'm guessing that's what it's in.
I've never even heard of that dichotomy.
Well, I'm right on Wiki right now checking it out.
Okay.
He may need to do some clarification because, let's see, top-down and bottom-up are strategies of information processing and knowledge ordering, most involving software, but also other humanistic and scientific theories. A top-down approach is essentially the breakdown of a system to gain insight into the compositional subsystem. In a top-down approach, an overview of the system is first formulated, specifying but not detailing any first-level subsystems. I could continue to read this, but
I said don't bother. I said I think both. Yeah, probably both. I think, you know, there's many different ways of looking at things. You know, I think even besides the top down and the bottom up, there's, you know, side to side and, you know, diagonal to diagonal and west to north and south to east. You know, people can look at things in all different ways and, you know, try to understand things from different avenues that, I don't know, I don't even know the relevance of that question really, but I appreciate him asking it.
Yeah, I'm perceptually, I think that either way, whether you draw a map of the engine as you're taking the engine apart, or you, you know, build a description of how you're putting the engine back together after, you're still coming up with the exact same manuscript, just in a with a different approach. And so I'll concur with you, Venger. I don't know how relevant it even is.
Yeah. Well, even though we've already crossed over into the undiluted truth, I'd like to, since the last few minutes have been talking about something else, I'd like to backtrack very quickly and read just the second paragraph of In Search of the Miraculous by P.D. Ouspensky.
Okay.
When leaving Petersburg at the start of my journey, I had said that I was going to seek the miraculous. The miraculous is very different. Is very difficult to define. But for me, this word had a quite definite meaning. I had come to the conclusion a long time ago that there was no escape from the labyrinth of contradictions in which we live except by an entirely new road, unlike anything hitherto known or used by us. But where this new or forgotten road began, I was unable to say. I already knew that, as an undoubted fact, that beyond the thin film of false reality, there existed another reality from which, for some reason, something separated us. The miraculous was a penetration into this unknown reality, and it seemed to me that the way to the unknown could be found in the East. Why in the East? It was difficult to answer this. In this idea, there was perhaps something of romance, but it may have been the absolutely real conviction that, in any case, nothing could be found in Europe. Yeah, I think that's a great paragraph, and I don't know, my makeshift summing up of the topic on Ouspensky, and I like what he was saying about that you know, there's a reality behind the reality we know and live in, and that. That something, some force, was trying to keep us from it, and that that piercing that veil is of the utmost importance, and that we can't find it, you know, just, you know, in books that we can just pick up from the library or you know, a magazine article here and there, you know, it's. The teaching has to come from outside. It has to come from some external convenience. It has to go beyond whatever knowledge or understanding or being that we currently have. And so I think in this way the East is kind of metaphorical. Or beyond our reality, beyond space and time, probably beyond our universe even. You know, perhaps universe B. But at the same time, in a very real sense, he was talking about Eastern occultism, Eastern philosophy, and that somehow they hadn't lost some of that primal knowledge that that they had acquired in the thousands of years before the 20th century.
I'm inclined to think that I get something completely different out of what you just read, that second chapter, and I do completely see every point that you raised as you raised them, but my original idea, my original thought as I was reading that particular section was Ouspensky's description seems to almost be prophetic in nature. You know, he knows that he's going to find something that's alien or completely unknown to the Western world at that point in time. The question that raised in my mind, rather, was did he have that same intuition prior to actually commencing writing this book, prior to actually meeting Gurdjieff? Did he really, I mean, I know he says, but did he really suspect that there was this outer dimension, this fourth dimension, all along from the beginning?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's why Gurdjieff sought him out, is because Ouspensky, before he even met Gurdjieff, wrote the Tertium Organum, and he talked about a lot of ideas that Gurdjieff told him that he didn't even fully understand. You know, he had knowledge that he couldn't fully comprehend, or his being wasn't great enough for him to fully realize all the cool and interesting and profound things that he was writing about in that first book. But I still don't know how your reading of the paragraph or your interpretation is different than what
it's not necessarily different. There's a dichotomy going on here. You've completely isolated it and broken off this particular portion that is intended in the meaning of what he was written. And my observation of it is different, and they don't overlap in that aspect. But they're both somehow still parallel, both somehow still occupying the same body substance, the essence.
Right. I don't see how they're not overlapping. Maybe you could tell me about your reading of it again.
Okay. Let me see. Let me re-examine this really quick. All right. What I'm saying is that out of all the substance that was actually there inside of that one particular paragraph that you read,
mm-hmm.
What I instinctively initially picked up and pulled out of it is completely different than what you picked up and pulled out of it.
I know. I want to know what you picked up and pulled out of it. I do want a different interpretation. I don't know what your interpretation is yet.
The difference of what I pulled out of it was that here's this man. If he truly had this kind of foresight prior to embarking on this journey, this mental journey with Gurdjieff, then really what I picked up out of it is of the two of them, in my opinion, he would be the one that was superior because he already intuitively knew it was there.
But did Gurdjieff know the same exact thing?
Intuitively, I don't know. I don't know enough about Gurdjieff prior to his journey over to the Middle East to study with all of these different yogis and
right.
monks.
Yeah. Well, from what I read, I'm pretty certain that Gurdjieff did sort of, you know, deep down believe that there was something he didn't know, and that there was truth to be sought, which was hidden, and he wanted to know it and then bring it out to other people. And that's why he went on his own journey. I think, you know, that kind of parallels Ouspensky's search for truth or search for the miraculous. Gurdjieff went there before and he somehow found a little bit more or something a little bit deeper than Ouspensky did when Ouspensky was traveling. And I don't know, Gurdjieff found a way to fully process it or awaken it inside of himself that Ouspensky wasn't able to until he met Gurdjieff. And then things started to really crystallize, and then Ouspensky kind of hit the ground running, I think.
Oh, I agree with that entirely. And again, you know, why we as humans always give credit to the guy that invented it or the guy that we presume invented it, and we never give the credit to the people who revolutionize it.
Right.
Unless it's just so boldly different. And I guess, you know, that's really what's going on here, is we didn't know enough about what Gurdjieff really was about and what he taught. I mean, he only published a handful of books to the general public. Now, there's rumored, to be hundreds more texts written by Gurdjieff, but they were kept within a small, isolated body of students.
Okay, so like transcripts of lectures, like that, you mean? Or
No, I mean, he wrote, but he says, I mean, in his first book, which I read a little while ago, if you want the title, give me just a second, and I'll pull it up, the PDF, to give you the exact title. But what he wrote in there was that he would only publish so much of the information that was available. He would only reveal so much to you so that you had to seek him out. The Herald of Coming Good, that was the name of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And we only have a couple of minutes, so I don't know if I'm going to be able to get to it to actually read the exact quote from him, but I'm going to try. But what he's pretty much saying is that he was going to hold, so much information back because he wanted people to come work with him.
Yeah. You think that was a mistake? Or
a mistake in the fact that if it wasn't for Ouspensky, delivering the rest of Gurdjieff's message to the public abroad, we may very well not know anything about this.
Right. Exactly.
So,
it seems uncharacteristically short-sighted or narrow-minded of Gurdjieff. I mean, I can understand what he was doing. You know, he wanted one-on-one, teacher-student kind of relationship and passing of that knowledge. But, I don't get it. Maybe Gurdjieff didn't have the knack for writing that Ouspensky did, and that's another reason that Gurdjieff wanted to use Ouspensky to further the work and pass his message along. I don't know.
Let's see. I'm digging through this to try to find it real quick. It should be within this first section, if I remember correctly. Okay. For almost 10 years, all kinds of fragments of the general mass of information intended by me for publication. I have, as it happens, finished only this day a preliminary compilation of the material designed for this purpose. Secondly, engaged as I have been in the course of the last 3 years in completion, parallel to this, of the first series of writings intended to head the list of my publications, I have also finally completed this work on precisely this day. So he finished writing everything that he had been writing towards, or was going to write over 10 years on this particular day that he publishes them. Thirdly and finally, today is the last day of term I had assigned to myself 21 years ago, of the term during which, according to special oath, I bound myself in consciousness to lead in some way an artificial life modeled upon a program which had been previously planned in accordance with certain definitive principles. This is all getting too long. I still need to get to where he's actually setting forth his intent about why he's only publishing the first part of this. How much time do I have left? Not enough.
2 seconds.
The show's over. So here's what we'll do. We will, in the future, after the Jason King show, come back and we'll take a look specifically at Gurgis' master plan.
Okay. Although I don't know if he actually did have a master plan. That might have just been more like hyperbole and whatnot. Two, I don't actually think that Gurdjieff was a great writer. I think, you know, teaching and actually speaking and being on one-on-one, I think that was Gurdjieff's strength, just like I think writing was Ostensky's strength. And
Certainly. I don't disagree.
Yeah, in comparison, I think Gurdjieff was kind of a shitty writer and literary teacher, just because his style and his prose is so overwritten and it's so not compelling. I mean, after 3 pages, I basically just want to fall asleep, because I'm just like, dude, get to the point. Like, if you were saying this, You know, you could say it to me in one sentence and it would have 10 times more power than the 3 pages you just wrote that are just, you know, overwritten garbage. But anyway, I'm a very harsh critic when it comes to writing as well. So,
I understand that. And I think that level of objectivity is necessary when you're examining things of this definitive nature. So, I think it holds true value. And in all of that, man, I'm not even going to play the outro song.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone's still listening to us, but oh well.
All right, well, anyway, have a good weekend, everybody, and we'll see you next week.
Yep, see you next week.